everybody. Welcome to the Psychology of Video Games podcast. My name is Jamie Madigan, and I have made it my mission in life to help people understand the intersection of psychology and video games, how psychology can be used to make better games, to understand games, and to understand what happens to players when they play games. In every episode of this podcast, I interview an expert on the intersection of psychology and games about a particular topic. I feel I should also mention that there's a website, psychologyofgames.com, and at that website you can find literally hundreds of other articles that I've written and published about the psychology of video games, as well as dozens of episodes of the podcast. You can also find information on how to subscribe to the website and the podcast, and how to contact me and follow me on various social media. You should go check it out. This episode is about a very basic question that I actually get all the time. Why do people play games? On one level, that's a pretty banal question. We play games because they're fun. There, done. Question answered. Riddle solved. But then again, I don't know about you, but that's not a particularly satisfying answer. Why are games fun? Why do people choose to play games when they could be doing any other number of things, some of which may also be fun or otherwise beneficial? And if we dig deeper, we can ask specific questions about features of games. Why do people like to chase achievements or try to beat their friends' scores or explore vast worlds? Fortunately for us, some very smart people have thought about these questions. In fact, I got a whole chapter about these kinds of questions in my book on the psychology of video games, Getting Gamers. Here, let me just read you a couple of pages. One of the things I've noticed non-gamers wonder about is why people play games at all. More than one newspaper reporter assigned to write about some hot new casual game like Clash Clans or Candy Crush Saga has tracked me down for some insight. Frequently, the interviewer simply starts with, "So, why do people play these things anyway?" Like I said, some clever researchers have also thought of this question, and many of them have paid special attention to things like quests, achievements, and collectibles. One of the first of these researchers was Richard Bartle, whose interest during the 1990s lay with MUDs, M-U-Ds, a genre of games that he helped create. Short for multi-user dungeons, MUDs were the text-based precursors of massively multiplayer role-playing games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft. Based on message board conversations and observations, Bartle conceived a taxonomy of MUD players defined by what motivated them to play a game. Killers wanted to compete with others. Socializers played to interact with others in less violent ways, explorers got joy from finding new areas or story material, and achievers sought to fulfill a desire to see numbers go up. Bartle's tests of this model weren't very scientific or extensive, but the idea that players differ from each other in terms of what motivates them to keep playing was an important one that others built upon. In 2006, Nick Yee surveyed 3,000 massively multiplayer online game players with 40 questions based on Bartle's taxonomy. Using a statistical technique known as factor analysis, which clumps questions together into larger concepts based on how people's answers tend to coincide, Yee found evidence for three types of gaming motivation: social, immersion, and achievement. In a follow-up study a few years later, Yee also looked at the relationship between player scores on surveys measuring these motivations and their accomplishments via World of Warcraft's achievement system. He found further evidence of the importance of these social, immersion, and achievement motivations based on what kinds of in-game activities World of Warcraft players pursued the most. Finally, one of the most researched models of why people play video games has been proposed and tested by researchers Andy Shabilsky, Scott Rigby, and Richard Ryan. Based on a framework called self-determination theory, or SDT, they argue that people engage in voluntary behavior like play or even work to the extent that it scratches three psychological itches: the need to feel competent at what you're doing, the need to feel like you're having meaningful choices in deciding how to do it, and the need to feel connected and related to others in the process. Self-determination theory calls these motivators competence, autonomy, and relatedness. Shabilsky, Rigby, and Ryan claim that to the extent that these needs are met, people will play games for longer and enjoy them more in the process. End quote. So, in this episode, I'm going to talk to one of those people I was just talking about, one of the researchers on self-determination theory, and its application to video games. We'll talk about how self-determination theory overlaps with good game design, and we'll talk specifically about where the space exploration No Man's Sky fell short, according to self-determination theory, and we'll talk even a little bit about its application to virtual reality games. That's coming up in just a second. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us on the interview section of the podcast once again. This episode, I've got Scott Rigby, who's somebody whose research I've been following and writings who I've been following for quite a while. And he works with a company or owns a company called Immersive, who does consulting work for people in gaming industry, people making games. And I'm sure he can tell us a lot more about that. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jamie. Great to be here.
So who are you and what are you doing here?
So I am by training a behavioral psychologist back in the day, whenever that is. I think you can say that on anything that's more than 10 years ago.
That's the rule.
I was on a path to be a researcher and be in academia and with a particular focus on human motivation and emotion. Then the internet started to become a thing, and I, being a geek, I sort of jumped out of academia and started to do digital media production and to get a taste for, you know, more of the commercial world of digital content. We built interactive games. This is back when, you know, just having an animated picture on the web was people would say wow at it. So you know, the bar was really low to create a good game, so I was able to clear it, and we did that. But that really gave me an experience in day-to-day practical world of media creation. And when I sold out of that company, I was like, what do I want to do next? I thought to myself, well, why don't I apply a lot of the behavioral science things to interactive media and you know, all the technology that seems to be emerging. And as a video game player, video games seemed like a great place to start. So I started to apply behavioral science principles to video games in order to understand them, but also help in the actual creation of them.
Very cool. So what about Immersive? What is that? That's your company, right?
Yeah. So Immersive is the company that does all of those things I just talked about. Really, Immersive's mission is to take behavioral science, and in particular, one of the core parts of our DNA, which I think we'll talk more about, is a theory of motivation and emotion called self-determination theory, and to figure out how in the building of products and services and marketing communications, how can we be putting things into the world that resonate with people, that actually improve their experiences, make them happier, and ultimately what we found is those positive outcomes drive all sorts of important business outcomes as well. You know, people staying engaged with products, valuing them higher, recommending them. And that, while we do a lot of work in video games, we also do work in the healthcare industry, getting people to stay engaged with healthcare apps. We do work financial services. So there's all kinds of ways we can apply this, but Immersive has its roots in about, I don't know, almost 14 years now of work in the video game industry.
Yeah. I first kind of came across your stuff and reading about self-determination theory, which isn't your theory, but you've taken it and applied it to video games in some really interesting ways. And you and I guess your co-author, whose name is escaping me, had a book called Glued to Games.
Yes.
Which kind of spells out like how self-determination theory is applied to game design and helps explain why people do what they do when they play games. And you have some great chapters in there about why are violent games so appealing and so forth. Let's back up a little bit then and talk about self-determination theory. So it's a theory of motivation. You want to kind of walk us through it and the framework that you've designed around it?
Sure. So the co-author with me on that book was Rich Ryan.
That's right. Yeah.
Who is actually the creator of self-determination theory, along with my other partner at DC. And so
to the source. Yeah.
Right to the source. Yeah. I had the good fortune of them being my mentors in graduate school. Mm. And we stayed in touch even after I left academia. And I circled around to them when I wanted to start the company and said, hey, let's do this together so that we can be, you know, there was a sort of a meta goal I had, Jamie, which was I wanted to create an entity that could serve both advancing the science of understanding things, but also could be a commercial entity and help people in the commercial space. And so we kind of have a dual mission in that regard. And it seemed like, hey, there's no better way to do this than to get the founders of this theory and close collaborators with me on the academic side to help across the business venture. So let me come back to your question on what is self-determination theory. So self-determination theory is one of the leading social science models out there in the world right now, and Google Scholar searches will confirm that, I'm sure, that is really about understanding the circumstances in environments, in interpersonal interactions, and interactions with, in all kinds of contexts, but the circumstances that help people to flourish and to have positive outcomes. And those include having personal growth. They include health. They include, energy and vitality. They include pro-social behaviors.
A lot of ground.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And that's one of the things that's enabled us. As I mentioned, we work in games, but we also work in health and financial services. It seems like an odd collection of things to work in. But really, what self-determination theory is about is understanding fundamentals of human motivation that cut across, really horizontally, cut across all kinds of experiences. So it's been applied, for example, to parenting and how to interact with kids effectively, to education, to another area we're working heavily in right now is employee engagement and work environments. And it's really concerned with, and I think I can take a couple of minutes here and give you the core of it, which
is please do.
Self-determination theory posits that we all have basic psychological needs. That we are bringing something to the party of experience, unlike other theoretical perspectives like behaviorism, which more treat us as organisms that respond to external stimuli. Self-determination theory is an organismic theory, which says we're bringing our own energy into the things that we pursue. And those needs are the needs for competence, which is a desire to feel successful and effective, mm-hmm. To also feel a sense of personal growth. All those would be rolled up into what we call the basic need for competence. The fundamental need for relatedness, which is a feeling of connectedness to another, where I really feel like I matter to you and you matter to me, right? And there's a mutual support, things going on. And then the third is the need for autonomy. And that is our mm-hmm. desire for us to feel a sense of personal agency. We want to feel volitional over what we're doing in life. We want to be the authors and the heroes of our life story.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean, and a lot of people, obviously have heard these words before, and in particular with autonomy, they'll think, oh, I know what that means. That means freedom, or that means independence. It really isn't freedom or independence. It's really volition. And volition, the difference really is that there are lots of times where I choose to be in a dependent relationship. I do in my relationship with my wife and with my daughter. I give up a lot of freedom and independence quite willingly and volitionally. And so I'm quite autonomous even when I'm being dependent. And so that's, it's those sorts of nuances. It's one of the reasons I find the work so stimulating, because those nuances become really important as we begin to apply these theories to the development of things like games or healthcare applications or these other things, because we don't necessarily need to be only focused on giving more and more freedom. We need to focus on building volition, and those are two entirely different things.
Right. Yeah, that's a good distinction. I hadn't quite parsed it in that way before myself. So, okay.
So that's a little bit about the theory. And then, of course, those basic needs. The one final thing I'll say is, once you understand those needs, then what you do is let's look at how do we create environments and circumstances that facilitate the satisfaction of those needs. And so we don't actually talk about I motivate you or I do this to motivate you. You can motivate yourself just fine. What I want to do is I want to create an environment that facilitates you being able to satisfy those needs. And when that happens, you will value those experiences, you will value those contexts, and you will lean forward into those experiences more. But the energy and the needs and everything, those are things that you're carrying with you. And it's my job as I'm building experiences to facilitate you being able to satisfy those needs and not to try to push you or pull you in any particular direction.
Right. And it seems like video games are one of those environments that are almost custom made to satisfy these three psychological itches or to scratch these itches.
Yep.
Any good game design has a sense of progression and getting better and becoming good at something. And they give you choice, meaningful choice, and they let you make commitments about your choices and sort of constrain yourself. But, like you said, it's volitional. It's the strategy you chose to build your character in a certain way or progress through a level in a certain way or play in a certain way. And then I guess relatedness usually comes up in the context of multiplayer games, right? I mean, you're doing things that are important to your teammates and to your spectators and so forth. But does that also show up in single player games?
It can. It's certainly much stronger in multiplayer context because you have a deeper complexity of real people there, and that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. We do see it happen in single player games. So if you're talking to, you know, computer characters and NPCs, and if they're richly drawn, and they, you know, when we look, for example, at quests in video games, you can look at how well that quest is satisfying relatedness needs, based on how much does the character giving it to you, you know, how much do they need you, how much are they depending on you, is there a payoff in the thing that you do and having an impact on that character or, you know, some interpersonal context that's constructed in the game.
Okay.
Versus just, you know, a lot of times you'll hear players complaining about, oh, it's just a delivery question. You know, quest
or FedEx quest,
the FedEx quest, and yeah, and what are they really saying there? Well, they're saying, well, you know, this isn't meaningful. There's no payoff. This person's like, please get this medicine to this town, or else everybody will die. But you don't feel when it's not done well. You don't feel that amount of emotional weight. It's, you know, players can see through that. But however, when you see games though that create that actual payoff in context, it's interpersonal. Even if it's a single player game, it can have impact. And there are games, you know, like Mass Effect or games like more recently Witcher, The Witcher 3, mm-hmm. Where you see the developers having put a lot of time into there being consequences and payoff.
Yeah, yeah. Entire branching storylines and characters react differently and options may differ depending on what relationships you've developed or not.
Exactly.
So do people vary on these different dimensions or in terms of like how much satisfaction they get from them? Like, do you and I, like you may be more motivated by mastery experiences and I may be more motivated by autonomy?
So I get asked that question a lot. So the one of the ways that I like to answer it is you can think about these basic needs in the same way you think about physiological needs. So you and I both have the need for hunger and for thirst, right? And that need for hunger and thirst it doesn't differ. I don't have more or less hunger or thirst need than you do. And if you and I don't engage, because it's global, it's just sort of there. Mm-hmm. That said, there may be different ways in which I satisfy my hunger and my thirst, and that you may satisfy your hunger and thirst. And so the ways in which people get these needs satisfied are a matter of personal preference, and they can take a lot of forms. And you know, that of course is what easily accounts for the great variety of games that's out there, and people gravitating to different kinds of games. It's also why though a model like our model, player experience of need satisfaction, has, you know, in the last 14 years we've been applying this. You know, that's forever in the, you know, in the history of games.
Right, exactly.
When we started, mobile games didn't even exist. And now we've got VR games coming out. So you've got all this evolution of different genres and styles. But because we're focused on the fundamental experience of basic need satisfactions and other things, we can very easily apply the model to any new thing that comes along. And what we're interested in is, because we're not interested in saying, are witches better than warlocks, or is virtual reality better than, you know, 2D, you know, fundamentally, we're interested in how do any of these things, how are they implemented in order to satisfy needs? And what we find consistently is no matter what the thing is, if people feel need satisfaction, they tend to sustain their engagement, be willing to pay more for the games or continue to pay for the games, you know, recommend games to other people. They even get well-being effects from games. And so,
by the way, witches are better than warlocks, by the way. They have the better hats. Just to put that argument
How can I argue with you?
Sure.
It's a poor example, probably. So certainly you and I, for example, everyone in my shop right now is playing Overwatch.
Me too.
And sure, and a lot of people playing Overwatch. Now, you know, Blizzard is one of the most amazing game companies out there. I'm still playing Diablo because I don't know, I'm old or boring or whatever people tell me here. but you know, I find when I watch people play Overwatch and you know, similar games, I can understand and I can see the need satisfactions they are getting out of the modality. For me, it doesn't particularly appeal, but that doesn't mean that I have different needs than they do. I simply satisfy those needs through different game choices.
Okay. So you mentioned the PENS framework, I forget exactly what you said, player experience need satisfaction. Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, so I see that come up. That's PENS, and I'll see like a paper or a study where let's say like we administered the PENS questionnaire. So unpack that, like what is that and how does it relate to self-determination theory?
So the player experience of need satisfaction is essentially a framework for measuring the player experience in games that is based on principles of self-determination theory. So we will be drawing from basic needs such as autonomy, competence, and relatedness mm-hmm. as some of the tentpole metrics that are in PENS. And again, I should back up and say that PENS is a quantified set of psychometrics, meaning metrics that are getting at discrete aspects of somebody's experience.
So these are like multiple choice questions that people would fill out in a questionnaire format?
Yes. So they could be, they're filled out in a questionnaire format. Sometimes they're multiple choice. Sometimes they're semantic differential. I won't, go down any sure. geeky rabbit hole of like, methodology.
Does this describe you or does this describe you where you choose between two words or?
Yeah. Some of those things. Yeah. For example, may have a continuum and say, are you more on this side or the other?
Okay.
And we have Likerts and we have other things in there. It's really been refined over the last 14 years using standard social science tools for internal and predictive validation in order to help us understand or get a experiential blueprint of what's happening in a game, and mainly being able to tie that blueprint back to different artifacts of the game's design or the experience. So, for example, we can look at an overall game experience and see that a game might be succeeding more on competence or mastery, but falling down in areas of autonomy. Hmm. I'm using a very basic example. And so we can look at the overall experience, but we can also zoom in and look at a particular level or time in the life cycle of play, either during the onboarding or later gameplay, and we can see how these needs are rising and falling in response to maybe the introduction of a new mechanic or a core gameplay mechanic that just isn't working, and be able to say, why is it experientially not working, so that there's the opportunity to iterate and tune greater success.
Okay, so clients working in, I guess, any space, but in the gaming space, for example, might come to you and say, hey, we've got this game or a prototype of a game, and you would do what? Run some focus groups or play testing or what?
Yeah, so what we will do, depending on the life, we work through all life cycles in game development. So sometimes developers are just coming in with, their initial design ideas, and we're heuristically applying the PENS need satisfaction framework against, what they're outlining. Hmm. In early stage, once a game gets into sort of an alpha playable state, we will then do play testing. We're not super big on focus groups. Sometimes we'll do in-depth interviewing with target players as a means of generating hypotheses that mm-hmm. we want to test about need satisfaction. But again, this is where some of our core scientific DNA really comes to bear in our process. A lot of marketing research methodologies just don't meet what I would consider to be, there's a lot of noise in them.
Right.
12 people in the room. And of course, these are well-discussed areas of what are the strengths and weaknesses of a focus group. They're not where we find the most value. So we would much rather be, before we even collect any data, setting up a slate of hypotheses based on our model that we can then test. Because, of course, what that means is when we're looking at data after the fact, we're not simply trying to find what we want to find
mm-hmm.
or staring at it And, you know, one of the problems with big data today, and this is, of course, working with game companies, they have access to tremendous amounts of data and telemetry. And, you know, data is awesome, but it's also something where once you collect enough of it, you can find statistically significant findings everywhere.
Any effect.
If you want, what we want to do is we want to create the most valid narratives and test them that we can so that we can help developers, you know, move in the right directions.
So then they might take that feedback and, I guess, ideally modify their games and maybe come back or...
Yeah, so typically it's sort of, you know, iterating to an experiential goal so they can take the feedback. And again, because we're so targeted and granular in how we give that feedback, it's more actionable because, you know, game development is an incredibly, incredibly difficult thing to do.
So I've heard.
You know, our goal is to give them useful feedback and then let them as the, you know, kind of the creative geniuses figure out how to, you know, iterate around that. We're not in the business of if people ask us, well, you know, something like you've looked at so many games, what have you seen work before? Or do you have any ideas about how you could fix this problem? If people ask us, we may venture some opinions about design, but our job is really to give, essentially, experiential x-rays and, you know, let them be the doctors. We want to deliver all the x-rays and MRIs and everything so they can look and say, ah, here's what's going on, then figure out what they're going to do next.
Okay. Do you typically include other measures on those surveys? So like a measure of, you know, other concepts like engagement or immersion or any of those types of things and then correlate those with your scales on the self-determination stuff?
Sure. Oh, yeah. We have, I mean, the full pens right now has got, I forget exactly, but it has dozens of subscales and things that we look at, and then looks at a whole variety of outcomes and experiential things. And then, of course, in almost every project, we also will be integrating, the very particular things that the developer or the game has set up as the key performance indicators so that we can see how the experiential metrics and pens are predicting those important outcomes.
So those might be things like amount of time played or conversion to in-game, in-app purchase or those types of things?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the business side of it. Or
yes,
you
know, yeah.
Would you buy this? Would you be willing to refer a friend? That type of stuff. Well, cool. So that all sounds very interesting. And I've also, in addition to that, you know, like in your book, you have some really interesting chapters there where you've applied the self-determination theory concept and those specific facets of it to some really interesting questions like, you know, why do we like violent games? Can you kind of talk about that?
Yeah. So the violence research, this is something that, mainly done again with Richard Ryan and also Andrew Shabilsky, who's a professor at Oxford now.
Yeah, I had Andy on the podcast a couple of years ago at this point, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so he may have talked about this a bit, but it really came out of once, and this is, I think, back when Andy was a student, but we were looking at, and we were all working together as a team directly. I remember there being a conversation where I had read yet another article about sort of attacking video game violence. And, I said, you know, I suspect that, and this is where why having a theoretical framework can be helpful. I said, you know, I suspect that it could be this sort of competence issues related here, which is that violence and this particular thing I was reading was talking about how when you shot somebody, you'd see their shoulder explode and the layers of muscle come apart and all these things.
Right.
And one of the sub theories that we have within our model is this idea of informational feedback from a game, providing you informational feedback is, am I learning something that's allowing me to improve my mastery? Mm-hmm. And there was a moment in reading that where I thought, you know, seeing a shoulder come apart versus seeing the head come apart is giving you an important information about how well you're doing, how well you're shooting the gun. So it may not be that people are excited about the gore or the headshot. It may be that it's a function of just feeling more competent. And indeed, and then so we got together and we ran these studies, and sure enough, that's what came out of the studies, that we actually manipulated a particular game. I think it was a Half-Life 2 mod at the time, because this was a while ago now.
Right.
We created exactly the same level design, exactly the same number of enemies, exactly the same amount. But in one version of the game, we turned the violence way up, gave people the biggest gun, put as much blood in there as we could. Another version of the game, people didn't even have a gun. They just ran around and they were like playing a big game of tag. And you would just touch somebody with your hand. And I'll be honest with you, Jamie, even I thought, well, there's no way people are going to get as much need satisfaction out of it. You know, we're not going to win on this one.
Right. There's something else.
And it turned out that the actual level of need satisfaction was, regardless of the blood and gore, was the thing that predicted whether or not people valued the game, enjoyed it, wanted to play it more. And so, you know, those were some, and we did a number of other studies, but to me, what it mainly showed is that by having this framework about not getting too tied up with the particular aesthetics or conceits or frameworks, but really just trying to get into how the mechanics of an experience, the core gameplay mechanics, about how those are need satisfying is really what matters.
Yeah, I love the idea that, you know, when you score a headshot in a video game and like your opponent's head blows up in this fabulously gory way, that the idea is that you don't love that. You're not a bloodthirsty masochist who loves seeing that. What you love is getting the feedback that, hey, you lined that shot up pretty well and you nailed it. And
that's exactly right. Yeah.
You won that encounter. And it seems like there's a lot of ways for game designers to take that information and then put it to good use. We were talking about Overwatch a second ago, and they do that to a certain extent. Like if you're playing Soldier 76, who is a guy who uses a rapid fire machine gun, your headshots do more damage. So they give you some visual feedback, but they also like change the sound that happens when your bullets hit somebody in the head so that you get that audio feedback relative to the normal sound that you, when you'd land a body shot. And when I hear that plink, 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 you know, I feel good, like, cause I'm doing well. And it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that their head popped off their shoulders, which it doesn't in Overwatch, but it does in other games.
Yeah. And it's about, and this is what games are awesome at. And, you know, some of the language you use around that are, you know, what's the density of feedback I'm getting, you know, for need satisfaction. Games are great at giving immediate and dense feedback, like the sounds, like the visuals. And, you know, and so this is, I think you put it very well, which is all we really wanted to do. You know, I'm a father, I'm a psychologist. It's not that I don't care about violence in video games. I think it's something that we, you know, need to keep watching. And I don't think there's any evidence. Let me put it differently. I think that there's been a lot of research that's tried to make this link between violence and bad outcomes and has not succeeded. And that to me says, well, you know, they've been trying really hard, so we can keep looking at this. And but from our standpoint, we're kind of Switzerland on that particular issue. I'm more interested in what's the value of this violence. And by the way, this goes to a very economic argument, but making the physics of a headshot is expensive for a developer. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. Making all of that gore is expensive. So if the value of it is giving this informational feedback about competence, to be able to say that to the developer, so and then say, well, there, if you can achieve this through other ways, that some of which might not be as expensive as the beautiful headshot, maybe that's, it will both maintain the experience with the player and also help you to reallocate time and budget to creating more content or deepening the experience in some other way. So we're just trying to put kind of practical value data on the table for people to consider.
What about addiction? Have you guys done any research around that or related that to the pens at all?
So we have, it's not a core area of ours. So I would say that I'm not an addiction specialist, but we have been very interested in this because, again, you know, we'd like to think that we're good human beings. And, you know, it's true that, you know, there's a lot of reasonable estimates that, you know, 10 to 15% of players out there are playing too much. And by too much, I mean that their play is interfering in the quality of their life, either their relationships or their school or their work or, you know, some element of their life. So it has the hallmarks of, you know, an addictive behavior. We tend to use the term overuse because addiction has, right, has other, you know, clinical qualities to it that I think it's unfair to call it addiction at this point. But I do think that overuse is an important issue to look at. In our research, though, we found something pretty interesting, which is when you look at need satisfaction, not just in video games, but when you look at people's need satisfaction across their lives, what we find is that the people who tend to be overusing games, meaning playing games for 25 hours a week or more, they tend to be people that are not getting needs satisfied in other areas of life. But we don't see evidence that the games are causing them, it's not causal, for their lives to be unsatisfying. If anything, the data suggests that people who have unsatisfying lives turn more to video games. And so overuse of video games will often co-occur in people that don't have as satisfying a life in other areas. But most people make the causal inference the other way. They think the video game play is causing that. Right. We see it more of a reaction. So it may be that, that when people are over-involved in video games, my first thought is, what could be done in their life, or what circumstances in their life could be enriched because they're probably spending that time in video games because a life that isn't as satisfying pushed them there.
Right. Yeah. You see that that idea come up a lot whenever people ask, like, well, why do people play games so much? Or why specifically, like, why would somebody who is a long distance truck driver sit down and play Euro Truck Simulator, you know, for 9 hours on their day off, where they play a game about driving a truck? Or, you know, why would people play cooking games or any of these other types of games that sort of recreate things that you do in real life and aren't necessarily as fantastical? And I think part of the reason has what to do with what you just said. Yeah, they're similar to activities that you do in real life, but they're engineered in a way to be satisfying that real life simply can't be, or often isn't. You know, you get feedback, you get to be good at something, you get to be important to people, you get to make choices unfettered by, you know, the typical constraints that you encounter in real life, like, you know, physics or budget or bureaucracy or those types of things.
Well, early on, or just a couple quick examples, when we started this work, you know, it's not always the most applauded area of study for psychologists to be like, oh, we're going to study video games, and more importantly, we want to understand what, you know, how we can make them more satisfying. You know, yeah. You can imagine there's a lot of psychologists be like, aren't there more important things to solve in the world? You know, one of the things that I remember I was hearing was we would talk about how the need satisfaction that players were getting out of you know, going through an open world and seeing a mountain and then being able to climb that mountain in the distance. And people would say, well, but shouldn't, you know, isn't climbing a real mountain, you know, more satisfying and more meaningful than losing yourself in this virtual mountain? And I remember a colleague of mine saying, well, that's the wrong comparison. That's not really what's happening.
It's not what you're choosing to do this afternoon. Yeah, it's not.
Yeah. Their option this afternoon is not to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Right. Their option might be quite, you know, pedestrian or boring or non-existent. And this is providing, you know, an immediate opportunity that's right in front of them to do something that's more satisfying than alternatives. And so, you know, I think that was a really important insight. But it's also, when we think about overuse, when people get who are doing video games too much, is that games do provide all of these goals and consistency. If I go after a quest and, you know, a game, I know I can go into a game and accomplish something in 5 minutes. I don't know. There are very few things I can think of, and I got a lot going on in my life that I can have that certainty of accomplishing something in 5 minutes. And so that's pretty compelling if you think about the basic needs that I was talking about.
Yeah.
To have that satisfaction. And so in one way, it's nice that they exist. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of video games. But I also understand that when people have more of a dearth of opportunity for need satisfaction, that games can pull them in too often or for too long.
Yeah. So this may be kind of a hard swing topic-wise, but when we were emailing before this to kind of set up the show, you mentioned you had some thoughts around No Man's Sky and all of this sort of stuff.
Yes, No Man's Sky.
No Man's Sky, for those of you who may not know, is sort of it's the exploration-based game where the idea is that you can have some ridiculous number of procedurally generated planets, and you can get in your ship and collect resources and fly to places and upgrade and explore and tag things. But it does largely seem to be built around exploration. I haven't actually played myself, but what were you thinking, Scott?
Well, so here's a game that, has right now, if you Google it on the internet, you'll see just a lot of hate. There's a lot of hate for this game out there. Because, as you pointed out, and I've put a fair amount of time into the game, but the promise of this game was very much what I would call an autonomy promise. I talked about the basic need for autonomy, this idea of agency and like you said, exploration, being able to be literally the master of the universe.
Yeah,
there are I believe the number is 17 quintillion.
That I'm still not convinced that's a real number. I think they just made it up, but right. I'll take your word for it. Sure.
It's like a snozzberry. It's not a real fruit, but planets out there and in this universe. And so of course this promise was I could play this game forever. They did this, they achieved this with a very small team, with a very small budget.
Like 5 people. Yeah. It's crazy.
I think it was a little bigger than that, but it was very small, independent developer. They used procedural generation, which for people who don't know is, essentially using math to create unique content and do it at scale without having to handcraft it and have artists and painters and other things. So I think as we were talking about it, like when people ask me about this game, I always say the same thing, which is the game – I won't get into the politics of did they overhype it or anything else. I think there were reasonable cases to litigate about all of that.
Sure.
But there are a couple of things about it. I think it's a game that is not it's not great. It's a good game. But if it does fail to deliver, but it's a very important game. And it's important because, we were talking earlier about creating game experiences and the evolution of the industry. And me being interested in how those evolutions might unlock new areas for need satisfaction. I think that No Man's Sky moved the needle forward on creating a scope of potential experiences, but they didn't quite understand that it wasn't the breadth of content. And frankly, the industry has made the same mistake a couple of times, and I'll give you a couple of reference points. But essentially it was saying, if I just create quintillion planets – that will be sufficient. The reality is that we need games that are creating a breadth of content with respect to need satisfaction, not with respect to content. And so, as I flew around to, I probably went to, I bet I put 100 hours into No Man's Sky, which puts me in about the, if you look at the number of hours played on Steam, it puts me in about the 0.1 highest percent of people in the game. So I've experienced as much of it as most dedicated players. But really, the reason I spent that much time is I had to shift out of what they told me the game was going to be in order to really experience the game. Because what they said is all the things you just said, think about our language for understanding games. You're going to grow and you're going to achieve this thing and you're going to, they even said that the goal is to get to the center of the universe.
Right.
So they would articulate a lot of this goal language. And none of those things really exist in the game. That was the problem.
So do you think that they talked about going to the center of the universe and establishing these goals just because that's kind of what's expected of a video game?
I do. I think it's because this is when we're players, we're evaluating a value proposition of a game. And they told me how big it was, but then they had to tell me in order to really communicate its value. Remember, value is based on my anticipation of need satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only if I, if you look, if you parse the language, they're using language that's related to growth, you know, which is a competence goal, and, you know, exploration, discovery, autonomy goals. But the problem is that when you got there, it was way too thin on any of those mechanics.
Yeah.
And so I think, though, that the reason I think it's an important game is 10 years ago, there was another game that came out called Spore, which Spore was, of course, Will Wright, who did The Sims, spent, I think, 7 or 8 years creating Spore, offered a very similar promise. We're going to create a universe with, I think at the time it was 500,000 planets, but, you know, still has the same functional goal. And they're all going to be unique, and there's going to be all this stuff. And, you know, Spore also overpromised in this way. But I would say that No Man's Sky pushed the bar further. So we keep reaching for this, and there are games coming, Chris Roberts, Star Citizen, other things that are promising this, these massive scopes. We keep opting in to, I want this experience, I want this experience, I want this experience. So it is a deeply, in some ways, Mass Effect also ran into this issue, because when Mass Effect 3 ended, everybody got super upset about the ending of Mass Effect 3 initially. I don't know if you remember this.
Oh, yeah. I played it, and I watched the color-coded endings, and they even issued a massive patch to try to undo some of that bad will.
Exactly. And the issue there was, again, an issue related to there was no payoff for what was supposed to be me creating, me, again, being the agent of change across this whole universe. So there's been lots of games that have promised but not delivered. And so the question then is, if we use a framework like ours, how can that help to focus on what needs to be fixed or changed? So I think if we could come up with ways to procedurally generate more dense mechanics around need satisfaction, that we can stop worrying so much about scope of content. Because if you go into No Man's Sky, it's pretty well done. It's pretty impressive. It was, you know, when you go to the planets, there's a lot of variety in the planets. People say they all look the same, but that's because when there's 18 quintillion of them, there's going to be a billion that all look fundamentally the same, except like one leaf is going to be different. So they should have just put in 1,000 planets
that are meaningfully different. Yeah,
exactly. They should have run the, here's what I would do. I would have run the algorithm and said, compute a second algorithm that looks at the delta between planets, and only when it reaches a certain point, yank that planet, give me 1,000. Now I've got variety. I've created more density. Now focus on systems to build these more meaningful experiences. But the only way, the reason I say it's an important game is it had, this game had to come out in order to even have this conversation. And so I think I'm optimistic that developers are going to crack this and figure this out. But I think that the key to it is focusing on the experiential variables and the systems to create the density of those satisfying experiences, rather than a lot of the technical wizardry.
Yeah, so No Man's Sky 2, just 3 planets. You heard it here first, everybody.
Well, yeah, right. Somewhere between 3 and 18 quintillion or a bajillion or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, that does make sense. And it seems like a lot of the things that you can do are not meaningful or interesting after a certain point within that game, and there's sort of no interaction with other players, or limited interaction with other players.
Yeah, don't even say that. Those will get by saying that, you get in trouble, Jamie, because this, of course, is where I do think they ran into some of this overpromising and even outright lying by some accusations. I haven't followed it that closely because I think they were betting on players never running into each other in a universe that big. But
have they?
Yeah, well, it happened in the first 12 hours of the game being released. But they couldn't see each other, and it was all, it is kind of, you know, when you read this stuff, it's when you read the passion that people have about feeling betrayed around these things, my first feeling is this is why, this is only confirming of there are basic needs that we have that are so sacred that you better align the experience with the communication of the experience, or you're going to run into this. And by the way, it seems to happen a lot around these giant space games, right? I mean, there were similar levels of rage over the Mass Effect 3 ending stuff. And I think that Hello Games people were getting death threats. I mean, crazy things.
That's awful. I think that there's probably a really interesting case study to be written about this, not only for the things that you described and things related to the design of the game, but also just the public relations and the way that it was handled or stepped back from and not handled at all. It was interesting to see, and maybe even something about the psychology behind setting expectations and perceptions of like fairness and, you know, did I get the product that I was promised, and how those expectations were formed and how those people came to think that they were promised something when it may or may not have been said. But yeah, like you said, I don't want to get into the whole thing because I haven't followed it or enough or experienced it directly myself, but it was burning up the internet there for a few weeks.
Yeah, it was. And I think the question is, if you look at the long play about relationships with customers, aligning the communications with, you know, with what the actual product does, but understanding what to emphasize in those communications. And again, when we work with marketing firms, a lot of times what we're doing is we'll do evaluations of marketing campaigns, game trailers, things like that. And what we're looking at are how well is this material in these communications communicating need satisfaction, because that's what builds anticipated value.
Oh, okay. So you can draw a direct line between the two, huh?
You can. Yeah, we can look at, and so depending on where you are in the PR cycle, we'll look at, you know, various things in order to be driving that. But of course, the best plan is when it all comes together in a unified way, that the dev team is working towards need satisfying goals that then the marketing team can easily pick up on, but then emphasize the right way in the communications. Mm-hmm. And you know, that creates a more unified cycle.
So I guess it helps if those teams, the development and the marketing and PR teams, are all speaking the same language and using the same terms to understand what those need satisfiers are and how they work, then that helps a lot as well.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Kind of thinking about, you know, self-determination theory and pens, and especially in the context of video games, like, where do you see this stuff going in the future? Like, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what do you hope it'll look like?
Well, you know, it's what I hope it'll look like in some ways is it's a little bit of a boring answer, because I just hope that games get better, right? Because we're dealing with fundamental needs, I don't think we're going to deal with any the needs changing or different things happening, but I would like them to get better at satisfying those needs. And I'll say a little bit more about that, which is sort of related to the conversation we were just having. I'll use virtual reality as an example.
Okay. Yeah, I was actually going to specifically ask about VR, so good.
Yeah. So I have not been a very bullish on VR for a long time. And so I'm just saying that to say that I am in no way a VR fanboy. But now that I have, and, you know, here in our labs, we have all the equipment, we've been doing some testing. I spend a lot of my sort of private R&D time now in VR games. And what fascinates me, I'm becoming more bullish on it because I'm interested in the new ways that it will unlock channels for need satisfaction that games haven't traditionally done well. And maybe we haven't even realized they haven't done it well. It's only because VR is coming that we start to see some of those deficits emerging. I'll give you a very particular example. I think that video games have to be, and I'm not at all saying that VR games can't do this. I think this is an essential element of video games, that we need to have goals and structures and things that we care about that are plainly presented to us that we can pursue. Mm-hmm. But that said, virtual reality provides something that I think is a bit different. Virtual reality may create a different relationship between players and games, in that in a lot of the virtual reality experiences I've gone into, I've experienced them as much more enjoyable when I engage in a willing suspension of disbelief at a sensory level. So where it's not a sense of me playing this game, but I'm actually engaging in this proprioceptive or tactile feedback in the environment and allowing myself to imagine myself, you know, in that position.
So you're talking about spatial presence, essentially, right?
I'm talking about spatial presence. I'm also talking about emotional presence in the sense of what if I were really hiding in the woods, ducking down behind a bunch of leaves, because if I don't, this robot thing crossing in front of me is going to see me and potentially eat me. If I put myself into, if I say to myself, this is happening, and this is flexing a new muscle, there's something very rich that begins to occur, and a lot of things that are very instinctual begin to occur. And I don't have an answer beyond that, Jamie. What I'm saying is that kind of exploration. The other thing is around exploration and things like that. So if we go back a little bit to games like No Man's Sky that are putting forth an exploration value proposition, you know, exploration in games traditionally hasn't been all that interesting because, frankly, there's not a whole lot to explore to do. Things are very limited. Mm-hmm. Even if the goals are rich, the actual, you know, I need to have the goals in order to help me know where to click and what to do and what to pursue. If you can create a VR environment where it's truly the case that I can lift up a rock and find something underneath the rock and begin to manipulate that in a way that's, there still has to be meaningful goals I can pursue. But I think that you have a deeper opportunity to use exploration as a need-satisfying channel because I can bring more intuitive actions to bear. I know how to lift up a rock. When I go on a hike with my daughter, I don't have a goal. There's no goal to this hike. People every day go out into the world and they do things that don't have a goal except experience. Games have not been good at that. This could help games become good at that. And I guess that's the best parallel to put to this is that idea of if people are out in the world exploring for the sake of exploring, but they're not doing it in games, I think it's because of the limitation of games currently that things like VR could begin to open up for us.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you think VR is going to take off in the marketplace?
I am continue to be bearish on that.
Yeah, me too.
I think that, look, there's a lot of practical problems, right? Which is most of the things I just talked about would result in me putting my head through my flat panel television.
Right.
I don't know how they solve for that issue. If people had problems with the throwing Wii controllers into televisions,
yeah,
what are they going to do with these devices on their heads flipping around their living room? So I think there are practical realities. Sure, cost is always a consideration, but costs always come down. Mm-hmm. I think that there are, in some ways it's fascinating. There's, for the first time, there's this molecular limitation on a virtual thing because we're starting to move closer to those things not being differentiated, right? So but I do think, though, I used to be also bearish that experiences in virtual games wouldn't offer enough value add over, you know,
a game,
the way we play games currently,
right,
experientially, to really justify all the extra work. But because of the things that I've been talking about, I think I could be wrong about that. But that's going to depend on developers innovating in creative ways. But, you know, they always have in the past. So.
Yeah, my suspicion is that this first generation will not, you know, be a mainstream device that a lot of people buy. But hopefully enough people get it and start, you know, developers start playing around and experimenting and figuring out what works and what the possibility space is. And, you know, academics study it and understand, you know, how it can be appealing and how it can be made to be appealing, and that it survives to make another, you know, round where the prices maybe come down and some of those limitations are worked out, and that it can have another go of it.
I think it's going to have a lot of applications first in areas other than gaming.
That's the other major thing. Yep.
But here's the thing that I'm sad about from a market standpoint. I think that if gaming, if it could be a major marketing gaming, the economics of that would drive virtual reality technology forward for everybody, including non-gaming applications, because, you know, people like Oculus and people like HTC, these guys would all have an economic reason to continue to throw money at it and move it forward. And that would benefit all its applications. But I don't know. We'll have to see. I really it's pretty interesting. I thought the Wii was kind of a fad, and it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
This may be on that path, but I think it's I don't think that's true. I think either it's going to succeed this time, or in whenever the next wave comes in 5 years, I agree with you. It'll succeed. It's going to succeed in one of these waves in some way. But I just don't know if this particular wave will be the one.
Yeah. And, you know, not to be crass, but I think if you keep an eye on the pornography industry and see if it catches on there, that might be a good lead indicator, because that sort of stuff drove like streaming technologies and use of credit cards on the internet and a lot of different things that found homes in other contexts and for other businesses.
Yep. Well, the word teledildonics is a real word for a reason. I used that word the other day with some people here. They looked at me like, what the heck does that word mean? I'm like, come on, you guys need to understand the porn industry better.
Use your imagination or turn safe search off on Google, whichever one. Yeah.
Yeah. Something's going to draw. I mean, I also think I haven't had a chance to watch. There's been a couple of films that have been released. I think Jon Favreau did one called Gnomes and Goblins or something, but traditional storytelling rather than games.
Yeah.
So I think that side is also playing around with the medium. So there are enough people playing around with this that, I think that even if it stays niche for the next few years, that some of this stuff is going to get figured out. I personally feel like augmented reality has got more of a near-term future than virtual reality, because it doesn't have some of these issues that we're talking about in terms of running into walls and televisions, but it also essentially creates a meta layer over traditional game mechanics that people are more familiar with and they already have schema for. Mm-hmm. So by kind of elaborating sort of games plus one rather than reinventing games, it may be a sort of an onboard.
Right.
It may onboard better, and it may also serve as a stepping stone to more VR.
Okay. All right. So we've been talking for a while. I don't want to keep it too long, but yeah, I feel like we could probably talk for another hour or so, but just a couple of questions to wrap things up. Have you been playing anything besides No Man's Sky?
Well, I stopped playing No Man's Sky about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I am playing Civilization 6 because
I'm jealous.
It's been out for 3 days.
Yeah, I'm jealous. How is it?
Too early to tell.
Yeah.
You know, as all Civ players, I've been playing it since the first one came out.
Uh-huh.
It's the long game that matters. So I've only been able to put about 4 or 5 hours into it. Okay. I would say that
Has a promising out of the menus probably at this point. And like,
yeah, I would say it's promising. I would say it's very promising. I think they've done some courageous things in terms of breaking from the old format. And so there's some relearning that Civ players have to do. But I think they've focused on the right things. They're trying to create a greater richness and density of satisfying goals and strategies and what if thinking about how to play that. So I'm optimistic, but you know, call me in 3 months when I've had a chance to get through a couple hundred hour, gameplay sessions.
Yeah. Yeah. That one's definitely on my list. At the time we're recording this, it's new game release season. It's just hitting us full in the face and there's all kinds of great stuff coming out. And there's only so many hours in the day and so much money I can drop on those things. So,
and plus I have a 5-year-old, so I don't really get to play video games hardly at all.
Yeah, there you go. I've got kids as well, but I have trained them to be gamers. And I thought that would be great because I could play games with them. And we do that sometimes. But day to day, what it usually turns out to is this: they're hogging the computer. They're hogging the gaming rig and I can't play.
So, oh boy!
Yeah, well, life is tough, right?
Yep. Be careful what you see. You stop being so effective at training your kids.
I should get them interested in sports or something. So, if people wanted to find out more about this stuff and more about you, where on the internet would they go to do that?
Well, they can go to they can follow me at CS Rigby on Twitter. They can go to immersive.com. That's with a YIMMERSYVE.com. And those are the best ways to, you know, find out more about us and get in touch if they have questions. And, you know, they can also do some literature searches in Google Scholar for, you know, my name, Scott Rigby, and papers will pop up there if they're interested in reading some of the scholarly work.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on. This has been a discussion that I've wanted to have with somebody for a long time, and I'm glad I found, you know, one of the people right at the source to have it with.
Well, Jamie, this has been great. This has been great. And so I really appreciate you having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks again.
Take care.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview and this episode of the podcast. You can find the blog entry for this episode on psychologyofgames.com. And you can find other information like how to support me on my Patreon campaign and how to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, etc., and how to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next episode.